Michael Explains, where I invite you to join the science teaching conversation with me about
the platypus, the extraordinary story of how a curious creature baffled the world, a beautiful, very intelligent book by Anne Morrell, a fantastic historical scholar, with sort of multiple levels of insight. I've sort of added my own, I suppose, insight. You can't help it, reading into it. And we're up to episode 10. Episode 9 was the shorty. Episode 10, The Platypus Man. And it's by Harold Burrell, The Mud-Sucking Platypus. Oh, thou prehistoric link, akin to beaver, rooster, skink, duck, mole, adder, monkey, fox, Paleozoic paradox. New men come in different guises. While the fraternity of Duck and Moy were pinning down the anatomy and embryology of the platypus and communicating the academic discoveries to scientific circles around the world, a young knockabout lad, Harry Burrell, was out along the Namoy and Manila rivers in New South Wales, cocking an inquisitive eye at the curious aquatic animal and putting together a store of information on the behaviour and habitat. Born in Sydney, 1873, Burrell had only had an elementary education and embarked on a wandering life, including a spell as a vaudeville comedian before he settled with his bride in the first year of a new century on the grazing property near Manila. Isn't that beautiful? Rather than 1901, the first year of the new century. So I wish I could think of those beautiful writing things, you know, to just pause and say, can I say it a different way? Yeah, Anne Morrell, you are a true genius of writing. There he stood, established a small zoological garden which kept birds and one or two marsupials, and while out and about collecting water weeds for his ducks, he met his first platypus and fell in love. A practically observing naturalist of the old school, Harry Burrell, who gazes from his photograph, is a tall, lean man with a get-up-and-go air, who, across an active 25 years, brought together and made widely accessible a wealth of old and new data in his classic work, The Platypus, which he published in 1925. For nature lovers, zoologists, and generations of fascinated readers, Burrell became a household word. Burrell's platypus of rivers, streams, and land was not romanticized, which is what you had to do previously in Europe to actually get, you know, a book. So a book was equivalent to a nature documentary, and, you know, its publications, if you could sell 5 publications to people making it accessible and readable, that would be great. But this is slightly different. Burrell's platypus of rivers, streams, and that was drawn from prolonged observations of living form. There was something compelling, sure, and credible about his accounts, which linked engaging animals' physical appearance and capacities with its daily life. The platypus is an aquatic animal, but its bodily form shows so very marked adaptation to aquatic conditions. During countless ages of life in the water, it has not developed the streamlines of porpoises and seals. Its body is squat, clumsy, and reptilian, as is short, thick limbs. The adaptations of aquatic life are mainly two: the enormous webbing on the 4-foot paw, which is an actual swimming organ, and flattened tail, which is used as a rudder to help diving. It's not a rapid swimmer, nor is it especially a graceful one. Isn't that beautiful? What a beautiful writing. I wish only, but, you know, if you actually listen to the lilt of people talking about nowadays, they are ready to cut you off with a bargain. We've kind of a bit of a commercial world. The lilting words of Australian speech to each other is gone, I feel. What the face unveiled. The small, bright eyes are remarkable only for their position high up in the head. Since they are not used for vision underwater, they have a somewhat they have come to be placed where they will be of most service if the animal floats to the surface munching its catch. The absence of external ears would seem a primitive character. In its place there is a curious modification of the orifice of the audius metis. The orifice lies at the posterior end of the facial furrow, the eye lying at the interior end, while the furrow is incompletely divided by two oblique folds of skin. The edges of this furrow act as a long pair of lids by means which which both eye and ear might be rightly closed at the will of an animal. The oral aperture can also be dilated and contracted while the eyes are open and can be cocked to catch a sound. The arrangement of lids serves to keep out water while the animal is submerged and earth while engaged in burrowing. So this is, this head has got two little lumps on it to crack a shell, eyes advanced, ears to the side, and it can actually scrunch itself up. The ductile snout, beak, snuzzle, all names which were Driffers, writers, theorists have deployed across the years, were sketched plainly for the reader's eye. It's like sketched for the reader's eye. Isn't that beautiful? The muzzle, which shows some resemblance to a duck's bill in dry condition, is different in the living animal. The naked skin is thick but soft, moist and flexible, very unlike the horny beak of a bird. On the upper surface is a slate coloured. On the under, it's yellowish, flesh coloured, often broadly mottled with greenish slate. From the base of each mandible, a circular flap projects backwards over the fur of its forehead and throat. The muzzle, with its flaps, is highly specialised sense organ. The whole of its exposed surface, both above and below, is pitted with minute pores, which extend onto its circular flaps and mark as sites of highly specialised touch corpuscles. When underwater, the animal depends principally on its delicate sense of touch for finding its way about. Even in an open air, it probably depends largely upon its muscles, since both eyes are placed so it cannot easily see objects straight in front of it. On the ground, it is well known that it can squeeze through very narrow spaces, and it is possible that the flaps are used to gauge by means of which you can tell whether it can safely go or wiser to withdraw. Whether this is be so or not, the flaps are assuredly a part of a great tactile organ and not mechanical shield. In some of the early figures drawn of dried skin, these slits are shown as standing up at right angles from the surface of the head. In the living animals, they are always laid black, back or flat. Now, this is an uneducated person who wanders around with no education is writing this beautiful, beautiful prose. And it just says to me that if you are enamoured with something and empowered and not under threat, you can produce beautiful work. Burrell, when he wrote, had access to Bennett Caldwell's accounts, he nods to the scientific writings of Wilson and Hill, but much experimental, experiential knowledge flowed from his own perception and examination of the animal that held him closely in its thrall. His observational field works in creeks and rivers were supplemented by growing skills in keeping platypuses in captivity. Alert to their habits, he devised, isn't that beautiful? He actually observed them before he kept them. Alert to their habits, he devised an enclosure, a roofed, covered brick structure, floored with a thick layer of river earth representing the burrow, and connected by a submerged tunnel to a wire netting enclosed cement pond, which resembled a kind of suburban platypus habitat. At first, in 1910, his efforts were experimental. Finding a female platypus in a river trap, he placed her in the enclosure, and shortly after he added two more females, and later, to the noisy annoyance of the sorority, two males. It was hardly a pushover. Platypuses are monumental eaters. Burrell, after working vigorously for 6 hours a day with Maddox and shrimping net to capture a diet of earthworms, freshwater shrimps, larvae, sarabeetles and pom snails, managed to collect an adequate 2 pounds of food a day. One by one, the captive animals died, while the surviving female comfortably, instructively ate the amount of live food through adequate for five platypuses. He thought adequate for five platypuses. After 9 weeks in captivity, having built her strength for the departure, she escaped by tearing her way through the pond's wire nettings. In Manila, and later Sydney, Beryl's knowledge of platypus grew. Highly selective in eating, its natural food resembled that of a bird rather than that of a mammal, he wrote. It will starve to death in the presence of food which no longer pleases it. It was, too, impatient of observation that the residents have resents been handled, and easily killed by too much excitement. In comparative studies, he found the echidna a dull animal, despite the fact that it had high mammalian convoluted brain. Oh, so it doesn't have a convoluted brain. There you go, it's picking things up. There was nothing stupid about the platypus. The brain, Boo reported, is surprisingly large, definitely mammalian structure, with cerebellum better organized than at the lower, so I don't quite understand, at the lower marsupials. And a large surface of the cerebral cortex, which denoted considerable intelligence. It was a point that a few years earlier had fascinated South Australian anatomist Frederick Wood Jones. The platypus brain, Jones noted, though built upon a lowly plan, possessed a great share of specialised cerebral cortex and grey matter. So, there's three parts, and it's the cerebellum and cerebral cortex. Just read them again. The cerebellum and cortex. So the cortex. Cerebrum and cerebral cortex. Going ahead in my brain. This is, you can see me rebuilding my memory by reading this. Burrell offered a precedent rider. From his long observation of the platypus in the wild and its convoluted bubbles burrows with their carefully constructed sidetracks, its acute response to warnings in its natural environment, and the successful attempts of the captured platypus to return to its home river, he connected that the platypus possessed a sixth sense. Whoa! This is the electromagnetic sense. Importantly, he was also able to shed further light and offer some robust deductions on the animal's breeding and egg-laying habits. After platypus mating, an event assiduous Beryl had managed to witness only twice across his watchful 25 years, a female yess left her accustomed feeding grounds and, given to solitude, selected an isolated stretch of bank suitable for nesting. One platypus stationed carefully within 5 kilometres of the river at exclusive command. All right. The nesting burrow was not the same as the used by the normal habitation. It was more elaborate. Its entrance was shaped like a low archway, after which a narrow passage led off in a sinuous way, sidetracks offering diversion, until it ended in a large oval nesting chamber where dry leaves and grass and tree roots would make up a nest. Such burrows were abandoned as soon as the young could shift for themselves. Well, there you go, it's a nesting burrow. Fossicking around the river bends, Beryl noted that at the earliest time he took eggs from the nest, the breeding season was in late August. On the same day in August 1925, he unearthed twin young, he judged to be 3-day-old, from the neighbouring burrow. He considered then that the date of the first egg laying was probably the first week of August. Watchful surmise was his rule of thumb. He showed foresight. The exact period of platypus gestation is still poorly understood today. Burrell's chapter were rich in detail. His practical eye picked up the information that either 19th century naturalists or embryologists on the cusp of two centuries had the divide. His further examination revealed that the platypus's two eggs were laid. They were invariably found joined together side by side, lying behind each other on the in the left uterus before laying, separated in the laying by a appreciable interval. Each egg was coated with a thick, sticky secretion from the oviduct walls. And while the materials of the platypus carefully plugged the burrows, protected the birth process from witness view, Brewer reasoned, and of course we now we have optical fiber scopes going down, Brewer reasoned that curled in the nesting, nursing nest, tail between their legs, she dropped her eggs from her calicum into her soft rubber-like hands and held them there for each until each egg capsule, in contact with another, became fixed together. And these subsequently clamped to her warm abdomen. Well, isn't that amazing? So they've got a sticky goo and she holds them and glues them outside. This incubation process also needed an imaginative projection. Buru believed that the mother incubated her eggs by curling about them and placing them between her abdomen and her upturned tail, a position in which she had once found a female platypus holding a minuscule young. He expressed the process aptly in verse. Look, isn't that beautiful? Oh. So, little known that scientists from Newton's era and stuff like that would use to introduce their, like, Newton's book principally has a verse at the start of it. He expressed the process aptly in his verse, the mud-suckling platypus. Ubic bone support, dimpled abdomen in short, in that slight depression, she incubates her progeny. Warmth increased for eggs and young by her tail, well underslung, snugly cuddled to her breast. Mother Nature does the rest. Isn't that beautiful? And I'm exactly thinking that myself in my alternative lessons, which I'm putting out there, different ways of accessing the information. The infant platypus, after hatching, Beryl found, unlike other mammals, were not suckled by the mother for several days, a finding he confirmed by extracting from the burrows and examining several mothers at various stages of tail dryness. Rather, the female's primitive milk glands remained dry until excited by mechanical stimulus by the movement of the young. Much new evidence emerged from Beryl's work. He consolidated knowledge and shared his growing intimacy with the animal, which in essence rejected the intimacy of man. But his own judgment of his achievements was modest. The platypus, his book concluded, is, from a scientific point of view, perhaps the most important mammal that exists, and a great deal of anatomical investigation remains to be done. But if intimacy defeated him, Buro's attempt at closeness led him to an ingenious invention of a portable artificial habitat for platypus. He named the platypusery, a vast refinement on the original suburban platypus habitat. It consisted of a tank to represent the river, a labyrinth to simulate the burrow on the bank, and a sheet metal tunnel connecting both by traversing sloping runways and several narrowly footed apertures through which the animal had to pass to the burrow from the pond. He ensured that it arrived almost dry to its sleeping quarters. This time he made a floor, not of mud, but which solid the pond, but of sand and shell grit, as no platypus tolerates water that is unclean. Oh, wow! Isn't that incredible? With the platypusery at his disposal, Buro was able to display the animal at the Sydney Zoological Gardens in 1910 and provide a tutelage for the dispatch of 5 male platypuses by sea and rail to New York in 1922. One survivor of the journey becoming the first live platypus to see and to be seen by a stampeding crowd outside Australia. The spell of 10,000 years has been broken, exclaimed the director of the New York Zoo upon the arrival there. Isn't amazing? The most wonderful of all living animals has been arrived. Insofar, the confines is far too distant native land and introduced aboard. He was slightly disconcerted, however, that the animal, so small for its half grown, could chamber a food supply so large. The country boy turned independent zoologist, pioneer without peer, as his colleagues knew him, liked to be known simply as the Platypus Man. He is commemorated as an unsung hero of the outback in the Australian Stockman Halls of Fame at Longreach, Queensland. What an Aussie. Now, he is getting to be what I'd call a modern Aussie, as opposed to these colonial cluts. Burrell's know-how and skill in handling platypuses in captivity passed on to a younger contemporary, David Flea, born in Flee, born in 1907 and trained at Melbourne University. Flee, who was a lively observer of nature and the wild from boyhood, appointed curator of the Australian Animals in Melbourne Zoo in 34. In 37, he became director of the Healesville Sanctuary, established a secluded rural region of Victoria outside of Melbourne. In the first year, he installed a platypusery. The first inhabitant was Jill, a tiny platypus that had wandered prematurely from its nesting burrow and found snuffling around the middle of a country road. 2 years later, as flames enveloped the ranges of Victoria, its devastating summer bushfires in 39, Jack, a half-grown male platypus, was picked up by a team of torchlight one evening, was plucked from the shrinking pool of Badgerys Creek. Philae's success in domesticating and rearing these delicate and unpredictable creatures in captivity was news flashed around Australia and overseas. 4 years later, his squadron performed a contract task of preparing and shipping three living platypuses to New York Zoo. Sanctioned by Fisheries and Games Department of the Victorian Government as a scientific educational mission, and long planning got underway to hunt for the desirable candidates was begun in the neighbourhood of Badger Creek. From a catch of 19... Now, can I say, no, Australia, you can't hurt, touch a native animal. So it's, yeah, what can I say? So you have birds here, it's very much like the domestic birds up around here. Do you feed them? Yeah, I think not. You've got, kangaroos, you're not allowed to catch kangaroos or anything like that, or keep them as pets. From a catch of 19 platypuses, three were selected. Two females, Betsy and Penelope, and Cecil, a placid male, and placed in a portable platypusery. After a sequence of adverse reactions, adjustments and delays during the animals gradually grew accustomed to appearing before the public. The arduous journey was launched. Isn't that? So they pre-zoo qualified them. In March 47, Finlay and three platypuses flew to Brisbane and were met by Pioneer Glenn from Melbourne, carrying food supply of 7,000 yabby, 136,000 worms, 22,000 live grubs, 23,000 live worms, 5 live frogs, and a ready supply of duck and hen eggs to make the platypus custard for their voyage across the Pacific. Every accommodation was made on the journey to keep the temporal animals healthy and undisturbed, and already emerged from their burrows for the evening to swim in the platypusery tanks. A sympathetic captain suspended painting the decks, deck chipping, and turned off floodlights, placed a vertical baffle boards to prevent the platypus tanks from the water slopping, muted the foghorn at night, and even changed course to avoid rough weather in the interests of the platypus army. When the food supplies run low, Pitcairn Islanders alerted awaited expectantly in their light boats offshore for the Pioneer Glen and the Patrick Zoo, with kerosene tins of worms. More live worms were flown from New York to reach the ship and Balboa. Isn't that incredible? At length, in April 47, a triumphant David Feely landed with three platypuses at Boston's for the flight to New York. It was the arrival of the first Feely platypus on American soil. 3 days later, the preview exhibition in the new arrivals of the members of the New York Zoological Society was ceremoniously opened by the Australian Ambassador to the United States, Norm Macon. The American and Australian flags were waved proudly in the cool sunshine. The Director of the Zoological Gardens, Fairfield Osmond, wrote in the Bulletin of the Zoological Society, Animal Kingdom, of the extraordinary wonder and excitement greeted by the animals' arrival in the US, exactly a century and a half after they first appeared in Britain. The day has finally come, the first that generations of American eyes could look upon the marvellous living mammals. On the day of their arrival, batteries of photographers and newspapers and new reels made in ray such that it would greet the most distinguished foreign visitors. Since then, radio magazines and press have all gone platypus. We're sure they would take America by storm, so they have. There it was, said Osborne, perhaps quote, something whimsical about the whole matter. Millions of years ago, the platypus had the choice of climbing the broad path of evolution to the upper levels of the mammalian hierarchy, but they continued as they were. So they still laid eggs, still suckled their young, and so remained living link between the misty eons of the past and the very bright summer's day in 1947. Fleury, the zoologist who spent 470 days of preparation for the event, and much trial and anxiety, is more practical. Quote, in the 20th century, he summed up, the fame of the amazing platypus has spread worldwide, far beyond its scientific circles. But don't underrate the difficulties the pioneers facing the eccentricity of the platypus. I still can't pronounce that word. It's a Latin word. Never did any furried animal offer a greater challenge to closer acquaintance. Now, because that's such a fantastic thing, I'll end that episode here and start episode 11 soon. Thanks for listening. What a fantastic way that's written. So the platypus, you know, the first one is the platypus needs so much food. It's amazing. And then it's even with, you know, tons and tons of food, the platypuses to get to the United States need a mobile platypusery. And things are cleaned. It must have a sandy floor in the platypusery. And even so, the ship ran out of worms and had to be restocked at Pitcairn Island. And the US flew out special worms for it. What a fantastic, fantastic story. These are real munchers if you've ever seen. And really they should have a fantastic position. Thanks a lot for listening. Another story comes to a close. It's been a pleasure sharing this moment in time with you. How you discover truly amazing things, understand them, and tell others. Thanks for listening.